Hey everybody, David here. So this is going to be part one of I don't know how many episodes on one battle after another. It is a movie that is generating a lot of conversation, and deservedly or not, you know, we can argue about that, I guess, on the podcast. It is certainly activating a lot of thought and critique across the film and TV media landscape. And we are also getting wrapped up in that. This is the third podcast that I've been on in as many days. And we'll see if there's going to be any more. I know there's going to be at least one more for the Lorehounds. So originally, Anthony and I scheduled with Jean to have a conversation last week, but then Jean had some family stuff come up and he wasn't able to join us. So Anthony and I went ahead and we're working on getting a schedule with Jean as soon as we can. In the meantime, Ron Dawson and JD, who both you might have remembered them from the Alien Earth Episode 7 coverage, they're on their YouTube podcast thing called Dungeons and Do-Rags. They came on to talk to me about the movie. I've got to still edit that podcast. That should be out in a few days. And then they had me come on their YouTube channel. And when they did one of their normal episodes with a couple of other buddies of theirs for their show. So, yeah, I know we're going to be talking with Jean. Just got to get that scheduled. And then so that'll be at least three from us on the movie. So after that, we'll see where we go with this. Regardless, it was a great movie to see. I'm looking forward to seeing it again. And I'm just really thankful for all the fun and interesting conversation that we've been having about what this movie has sort of sparked in the general discourse. Okay, I think that's about it for setup for this conversation. In terms of what we've got coming up on this schedule, I think Alicia has one more Peacemaker to come out. I've got one more bonus episode for Alien Earth, and then that should wrap the season. Nicole and I are going to be talking about some psychology-related stuff. And then we're in the middle of Spooktober. We've got three Zach Krieger films that we're covering. We're covering Weapons on the main public feed. And we'll be talking about Barbarian and Companion. We'll be doing a lore down on the subscriber feed. I know Alicia has a bunch of Frankenstein projects also in the works. The new movie is coming out, so I'm sure that'll be out before too long. And then I think she's got something else special going on Warship Dust. Then I think there is a Marvel Zombies also in the works. And I know Alicia and I are going to be talking about Predator Badlands once that is released. In terms of television shows, John and Alicia are talking about covering It, Welcome to Derry, and maybe doing some check-in pods on Talamasca. I'm definitely going to be covering the new Vince Gilligan show, Pluribus, once that comes out. And then Radioactive Ramblers are going to be covering Fallout in December as well. We'll have our end of year nonsense that we usually do where we rank all the TV. There was a lot of TV this year. We'll get that out as well. And I know that there's some Christmas rom-com stuff in the pipeline. So stay tuned for all of that. Thanks again for being subscribers. Thanks again for just being listeners. We appreciate all of you. And yeah, here's my conversation with Anthony about one battle after another.
I relate to Bob in a few ways.
Stuck on weed? Are you broken on weed?
Oh, goodness.
Anthony, thanks for jumping on. We're recording now. Sorry, I right. record on
I'm,
you.
I'm happy. No, I was just saying I relate to Bob in a number of ways, which we can talk when we get to spoilers. But there's a few sort of sad sack adult male, you know, subordinate masculinity issues that he has that I can relate to for sure.
So I think this is going to be the first of maybe several conversations about this film. We were initially scheduled to record with Jean. His spouse is feeling a little unwell, so he needs to attend to his family and be a good father. And just given the next couple of weeks, scheduling is going to be a little bit nuts. And we are very clear that Jean has some things that he would like to to talk about. And we're going to make sure that he has that opportunity, and what configuration and at what time frame that happens will be to, we'll just figure that out at some point. But you and I wanted to talk anyway. So I think this is kind of the opening chapter. We can talk about a number of the other themes and ideas that are happening in this movie, because it's a milfoil, right? It's a huge, so many layers. And then I'm going on the Dungeons and Do-Rags podcast with Ron and JD this Friday, and I'll be on their show.
Yeah.
And I may cross post the episode back to our feed. So that'll be a good conversation. And Ron has been around the Lorehounds for a little while now. JD is a buddy of his, and they were with me for episode 7 of Alien Earth. And we got a lot of positive feedback from their episode. So they invited me over there. So we'll do that. And then, I don't know, I just see multiple conversations happening around this movie.
Yeah, David, I'm fine with all of this as long as we can sort of be unified in our fight against haters, lunatics, and punk trash.
That's the phrase of the century.
I feel like that's going to stick with me. the unholy trinity.
That's right.
Haters, lunatics, and punk trash.
Punk trash is the best.
Oh, goodness.
How many times have you seen the movie now?
Only twice.
Okay.
I saw it the night it came out, really kind of geeked out for it, and just saw it again last night.
Oh, wow. So it's fresh.
It's fresh, and I wanted, I've been wanting to kind of see it again anyway, and I got to tell you, I don't know if people are talking about it, this movie, in this way, but it's hilarious. It's just, it's an action thriller. It's all the depth that you'd expect from PTA, but I just laughed really, really hard from, probably like the middle hour. There's some really serious stuff at the beginning and some really serious stuff thematically at the end that's worth talking about. But I don't want it to go unsaid that I laughed harder in this movie than most movies that are intended to be comedies. So anyway, it's delightful. If you kind of are getting that the Christmas boys are just, they're just so comic. I mean, they're cartoons. They're just cartoons. Right, so anyway, I don't want to spoil anything early on here, but I just thought this movie was hilarious.
Well, I think for the purposes of your and I conversation, we might as well just lift the spoiler safety now.
Okay.
Yeah. And then just launch in, because this is going to be a multi-podcast conversation, I think. We don't really need to stick to a lot of forms and structures, given it's just you and I, kind of shooting the shit. And spoiler warnings. We're going to just spoil the whole thing going forward. So if you haven't seen this movie by now, you're sleeping on it. I've only seen it once. It is still, a lot of it is clear in my mind at a broad scale. I was just looking today because I was reading about VistaVision. And one of the four theaters that can actually play the movie in native VistaVision is not too far from me. In fact,
really?
It's my wife's home suburb of Boston.
Interesting.
Okay. And so we were like talking about maybe going and seeing it. We're like, we have to see some family in the Boston area, and we might, I don't know. We'll see. But if I can see it in VistaVision, I kind of really want to.
Yeah, that sounds interesting to me. I'm not really one for, like, this is going to sound weird, but I see movies in my mind.
Okay.
like there's a little screen projector in my head, because if I'm in the movie, I tend not to be thinking about, like, whether or not the definition is working, or what the media surround is
so doing. You're watching the movie, watching yourself, watching the movie. I'm trying to describe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I've never really felt like, I mean, there are very few movies that I feel like I could really tell the difference between the 4K and the standard, it's not how my mind works.
Right.
That is something that I would be interested in, because of the really odd choice to choose this outmoded film.
Right.
to choose the movie and, you know, only to show it on a few theaters in that way, that does intrigue me.
And I'll just put a quick note in here about VistaVision. The big thing about it is that it runs, the film is exposed, the film, so it's actual film, it's not digital.
Yeah.
And the film is running horizontally across the lens.
Okay.
As opposed to vertically. And so you're getting different perforation per second, sort of a type of frame rate. And so you, because of that setup, the physics of it, I don't understand it. It captures more detail and it creates a greater depth of field around the image. And so there's a bunch of qualitative things. And so in this movie, it was all film, as I understand it,
mm-hmm.
and it's a mixture of 35 millimeter and VistaVision. And there's only some scenes that are VistaVision. But then they actually went and spent the engineering time and financial resources to re-upgrade 4 theaters around the world to play it in the VistaVision format. Otherwise, they've converted to 70 millimeter and 70 millimeter IMAX and normal formats as well. But yeah, they shot this whole freaking thing on film,
yeah,
which is wild in this day and age.
Well, I wanted to throw an idea at you about this.
Please.
Since we're full into spoilers. In an interview, DiCaprio said that he couldn't stop thinking about the parallels between this film and Star Wars.
Whoa. Okay.
And when I was watching it the second time, all I could think about was Star Wars. Like this movie is
trying
just
to map it.
This movie is just a retelling of A New Hope. And everything down to sort of like, you know, the backstory of Darth Vader and how sort of the anti-hero, you know, the anti-hero begets the hero of the movie, and you've got a rebel force and you've got an evil empire. And then at the end, you know, you've got this, you know, sort of hint of a reconciliation, and even down to like those little music wands that I think were sort of a technology just created for this film. Whereas if your little wand is next to
that was a Motorola pager. I had a friend who had one of those.
Okay. That actually plays the music?
No. So my headcanon for that is that that's an actual old school pager. Those were the early pagers. And that he modified them.
Okay.
To be able to do that. But I'm
to modify them to look a little bit like Darth Vader's lightsaber.
Okay, that's weird.
Okay, because they're like more like a wand shape.
Uh-huh.
And for most of the time, they give a little red light.
Yeah, right.
And at one point, you know, Willa's laying, you know, she's totally forsaken. She's laying on her bed. She's crying. And you just see the red light in her face and she's holding on to that thing.
Interesting.
And of course, her father, who's sort of, you know, the veteran in the, you know, the Rebel Alliance, he's got one too. And it's also red if they're not together. But as soon as they get together, it turns the color of Luke Skywalker's.
Oh, that's wild.
And so there are just little things like that that made me think like, oh my gosh, this has so much in common with A New Hope.
So I'm looking at a Motorola Metro Page Boy that is $25 on eBay.
And it's so that same shape.
Yeah. It's that stainless steel box. I have a visceral memory of these. Oh, here's one for $11. Looks like it's a bit of a knockoff, but I have a visceral memory of a friend who had one of these. Don't ask me why he had one in high school, but he had one. Somehow he
did. They light up as either green or red. All right. Nope. So for me, that's the crucial thing, is the shape of them. And it's the sort of the glow that they represent.
Right. And that was part of the that's what I took away, that it's old tech, right? Cause they're talking about old cell phones and they don't monitor those frequencies anymore. And so they took some old tech and then modified it. And for whatever the form factor, the battery, the you know, the electronics, the existing electronics that they mm-hmm. can hijack for it. So mm-hmm. that's my interpretation.
So anyway, I thought that was an interesting.
That's very interesting.
Connection. I don't know if it's intentional, but there's. Oh my gosh, it's really hard not to see Star Wars once you start looking for it.
No, I'm stuck. Now I'm going to, it's going to be in my head when I go see it next time.
So what was your experience of this movie? I'm curious at like your anticipation running up to it. What did you expect? And what was sort of your takeaway afterwards?
I had no idea what this movie was going to be. I literally... had no plans to see it until you texted me and you're asking, oh, you know, are we doing is anybody doing a one shot for one battle? And yeah. I was like, no, cause I thought that this movie was some kind of hybrid, interpretation of the Big Lebowski and the Taken series.
It's not those things.
I know. I realized that after the fact that it is kind of like that.
Yeah.
But I had no idea. And so when I was watching, when the film opened, I thought that I was watching the trailer. So my theater on the afternoon matinee that I saw, they didn't run any trailers on the front of it. They just uh-huh. went straight into the film. And I thought, what trailer is this movie for? I had no idea. And then until I saw DiCaprio, I was like, oh, this is the movie.
Yeah.
And then there are parts of this movie that shook me to my core.
Huh.
Specifically around the tactical forces that were being deployed in the battle of the town. I'm blanking the name of the town right now off the top of my head. And
filmed in Eureka, by the way, which is Northern California.
What's the name of the town that they're in there?
Is it Bacton Cross?
Yeah, Bacton Cross. That's it.
Yeah.
And then some of the stuff when they were hunting down the French 75.
Yeah.
I think there was a scene where one girl leaves out the back door of a place. And then as she runs out the door, they shoot her in the head as she goes out.
I was so shocked by that.
It shook me.
Oh, yeah. And my wife kind of jumped because, she was sort of like a really important character mm-hmm. in Licorice Pizza.
Oh, I haven't seen Licorice
Pizza. And I thought she absolutely is going to.
Is that Haim?
What's that?
Was that Haim? That was Haim. That was one of the Haim sisters.
I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I just thought she's going to be really important for this movie. She'll be there to the end. And so for her to just be summarily executed like that, it was just jarring, just totally shocking.
It sends the signal of what kind of movie you're watching.
Right. That's right. I mean, and I'll get to it toward when we get to the end of the movie, but it did kind of set me up to like just be completely disoriented. Like
yeah.
I don't know what could happen over the course of this movie. Anything could happen.
And so there's this deadly serious deployment of quote unquote law enforcement, you know, paramilitarized law enforcement.
Yeah, yeah.
That terrified me because when you see how effective these guys are, so I can only imagine what's happening in Illinois right now and other places in our country that really, it really upset me in that regard.
Yeah.
And then it was freaking hilarious. And right. Then it's a father-daughter, and it's a chase, and it's the Christmas boys, and you're just like, okay, this is Paul Thomas Anderson is holding up a mirror, a clown-style show mirror to us to go, look how ridiculous fascism and white supremacy is, and their inherent contradictions, and blah, blah, blah. So all that stuff. So I walked out disoriented, but visually... I had that experience of being transported, like when I saw Dune 2, you know, Villeneuve's movie Dune 2. I had that transcendent moment where my eyes sort of went bug-eye, opened my jaw, went slack, and I was transported into some other place. When cinema can do that, that's intense. And the rolling... you know, the ocean waves of us rolling up and down on the road and that kind of stuff just breathtaking visually, right? Like, you can say what you want about story and revolution and how Black women are being portrayed on screen and all of these kinds of things. There's a lot of conversation to be had, but at the end of the day, it's just it's an amazing film with an amazing structure and an amazing purpose and point of view. The Les Miserables, yes. There's like a whole Les Miserables thing that's going on with this.
I think so. Yeah.
Sure. And I'm not an expert on that, but the way that he constructed the story and the way that he took the book, Pynchon's book and all of this stuff, it's just, I don't see another film seriously challenging it for Best Picture at the Oscars next year.
That's interesting. Let's have that conversation in a little bit. I do want to talk a little bit about the prologue of this movie.
Yeah, let's do it.
Because to me, the prologue of the movie was so arresting. Act one. Yeah, mm-hmm. Act one, when sort of we meet Perfidia Beverly Hills and the French 75. And this all sort of happened 16 years before sort of the climactic moments of the film. That part to me was very disorienting. And it was very, I really couldn't tell who were the good guys and who were the bad guys. I mean, there were certainly, you know, Sean Penn is certainly a bad guy. There's no question about that. I mean, he could be one of the best villains, worst villains in film history in this movie. But I really think that Perfidia is almost propped up as an anti-hero.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I kind of had a different view of her in conversation with my wife after the movie, but toward the beginning of the movie, it really kind of brought me to the same place that Civil War brought me to.
Mm-hmm.
Not Marvel's.
No, Captain Alex America. Garland's 2024.
Right. Because I thought, oh my gosh, that movie is...
It's big time in conversation with this.
Yeah. I felt like both of these movies really had a lot to say about the present state of our country. And yet... There was and because of that, the violence in the movie felt more depressing than maybe a sort of a movie like Star Wars, because it did feel so real to life. Like this could be our world in 1 year. This could be our world in 2 months. You know, it really did give me that sense. And I was,
which is crazy when you realize that when did he write it? How long he's been writing it? And
what the book is basically built on sort of the Weather Underground and the aftermath of the Weather Underground. So,
right. And in Reagan era.
That's right. Politics. Yeah. Yeah. So I really feel like there's a sense in which that prologue is meant to create more problems than sort of a rah-rah aren't the progressive revolutionaries fantastic?
The heroes, right.
I don't think that this movie brings me to that place. Mm-hmm. I think by the end of the movie, I'm absolutely rooting for Willa, you know, and her fight to change the world. Like that, to me, there's no question about that. She is Luke Skywalker at that point. But the prologue of this movie really had me disoriented and depressed and not knowing if there was going to be any real good guys to root for.
Right.
But it's such an important early stage of the, I mean, you can't tell the second part of this movie without that setup.
And I think that goes into the Les Mis comparison, where it's all this aftermath of the barricades. And I'm not a Les Mis expert, so it's hard for me to talk authoritatively about that, but my understanding is that there's this intensity and then there's this whole shattered aftermath that the characters have to sort of work with. I think too, you mentioned Civil War. I had that exact same thought, but I also then hadn't watched, but then subsequently, like I think the next night I watched How to Blow Up a Pipeline.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know if you've seen that movie.
I have, yeah.
And to me, these three films are at some level. I mean, One Battle is doing some different things on some different levels. as well. So there's some unrelated stuff, but in this area of what does America look like in the future, these three films are deeply in conversation with each other.
I think so. And I don't know if they're trying to be like,
I think so. I think
I'm it's pretty an, sure. An I mean, honestly, like I feel like PTA is in conversation with like 9 different Scorsese films and 3 different Tarantino films.
100%.
And a couple Coen brother films. I think that there's a lot of those movies that kind of get little hat tips and nods and homages in this movie. But I don't know if Garland is trying to be in conversation with this movie or vice versa. I just don't know how much they knew of these movies going in, but there's so many parallels.
Exactly.
That it makes you, you know, it makes you wonder. It makes you wonder how much these guys were aware of their work going into it.
Well, it's a zeitgeist conversation, mm-hmm. like the disaster films of the '70s, you know, with the, it's not Titanic. What's the movie? The ship one. Anyway, there's all the airport ones and, mm-hmm. Towering Inferno and, oh, the Poseidon Adventure, mm-hmm. all of that. Right. That was our fear of industrial catastrophe was coming out on film or, mm-hmm. or the environmental disaster films of, you know, the '90s and the 2000s. So I think, mm-hmm. I think whatever is bubbling up, it's been bubbling up for a while. And I think our artists are, you know, people who are modern storytellers are being, you know, the vibrations are there that they're picking up on.
For sure. And it's interesting that Paul Thomas Anderson is making a movie like this because he usually makes period pieces. And he'll have something to say about, you know, American capitalism, mm-hmm. and, you know, the oil industry or, you know, the early stages of, you know.
It's called drainage.
Yeah, right. He'll have social commentary like that.
Right.
But he'll usually put our era in conversation with a previous era.
Mm.
And
mm-hmm.
this is really the first film that he made that's clearly speaking to a moment in time and also set in that moment of time.
Mm-hmm.
So
how big of a Paul Thomas Anderson aficionado fan?
I'm pretty big.
Where are you?
Yeah. I'm pretty big. I think that there's movies that I've seen, you know, a lot of times. And then there's movies I've seen once. Like I don't feel like I need to see The Master again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I recognize it as this is a brilliant movie. Mm-hmm. I feel kind of gross. I'm not going to watch that again. Right. And then there's other movies that I think I've seen Licorice Pizza like 4 or 5 times.
Wow.
So I'm a big fan of, you know, Boogie Nights. I'm a big fan of Punch Drunk Love. Shout out to Properly Howard. Steve and I just covered Punch Drunk Love recently. I think he's brilliant. I think he's one of our best filmmakers. He will do one of these things that Scorsese does, and that a lot of his movies are about the slow depravity of a man's psychosis that's bringing down not only him but the world around him.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, is interesting. It's an interesting character study to do it that way. It's just not my favorite kind of film. Last night I watched the first hour of A Phantom Thread, and you know, these are films about men who are hyper competitive and domineering, and it brings a certain kind of psychosis into them and the people around them, and it's fascinating. And I don't know if anyone does it better post, you know, Scorsese in his prime, but I do think that a lot of these films don't want to give you a neat, nice silver lining at the end.
Mm-hmm.
He would much rather, you know, have someone's blood spilled out on the floor.
on the bowling alley floor.
This movie ends, I think, in a very hopeful way.
Yes, absolutely does.
And it kind of follows a few familiar action movie beats.
Mm-hmm.
to kind of make you feel good at the end, even though the darkness remains, there is a silver lining at the end of this movie.
Right.
Which I found really surprising. And because of that, I do think this may be my favorite PTA movie.
Okay.
I need to let it sit for a while. I need to let it, you know, ruminate. I need to maybe go revisit Boogie Nights or whatever. But I do think that this movie has a real solid chance of being my favorite movie of this.
Hi, Alicia from the Lorehounds here. I'm genuinely excited about this new sponsor we're working with this fall because they've played an important role in my family's holidays and special events for many years now. I'm talking about Uncommon Goods, my and my family's favorite place to buy gifts for each other. Their official tagline is Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else, which is absolutely true. But if you know me at all, you know that I get excited about unique, quirky products made by artisans and other creative people. I just personally love scrolling through their website and stumbling across such specific items I'd never find anywhere else. Over the years, I've gotten everything from personalized puzzles to retro viewfinders with family photos to beer brewing or wine aroma kits. And my latest purchase is a 3-in-1 convertible bag. It's a gift for my mom to thank her for everything she's done to help me through my tougher moments. And I'm getting started on my holiday shopping earlier this year, too. Need to make sure that I leave plenty of time for gifts to arrive with the recent unpredictability in shipping. If you're thinking the same, then good news. We can offer you a 15% discount when you shop on Uncommon Goods and drop our name. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/lorehounds. That's uncommongoods.com/lorehounds for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
I was surprised when I went to look at his filmography, how few films of his that I had seen.
Oh, interesting.
I had literally only seen two of his now 10.
Interesting.
Boogie Nights and There Will Be Blood.
Okay.
And so I went and I watched, I had a little cold or something at the beginning of last week. And so I kind of had a day and a half where I was like, I can't work. So I'm in bed. And I did a 3 movie run of Phantom Thread, The Master, and then There Will Be Blood in that order. And I don't recommend that anyone do that. Because you have 3 domineering men who just mind bend the people around them.
Yeah.
In the worst, I don't know how to categorize that. I did enjoy Phantom Thread though, because it did have a glimmer of positive note in the end. Yeah, they're both really messed up people in a lot of ways, but they're in love and they're together.
I guess spoilers. If this works for them.
Yeah. Know. So, exactly. And clearly he is the Phantom Thread character is. I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but I would clearly put him on a spectrum of some kind. And I don't wonder if that's part of what his storytelling is, isn't there, how do we look at these people who are extremely driven, highly successful and do extraordinary things in the world. Mm-hmm. And then we have Bob.
Right. Okay, let's talk about Bob. I feel like, you know, this is a DiCaprio joint.
Yeah.
I do think that there's something about his star power. Go ahead.
Just a very quick question about DiCaprio and this role. I don't mean to interrupt, but I kind of think this movie is a perfect, this character is a perfect character for DiCaprio. He needs like a hyperactive shtick, or for his shtick to work.
Interesting.
The character has to be an over the top kind of character.
That's really interesting.
A Wolf of Wall Street kind of.
Did you think that this is over the top?
Because he's constantly fumbling and screaming "Viva la Revolution!" Right, and he can't remember thing, and he's they them stuff.
I mean, he's a lot of that. Was a lot of it is him being a sad sack, though. I mean,
but he's so into it; like he commits to the bit fully.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think that that's interesting to me. You know, it's hard not to put this performance in conversation with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you guys just covered it, and I watched it after your podcast on it.
So, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Yeah, what a great movie.
It's weird. I don't know. I'm still processing it.
In that movie, he's sort of playing the classic movie star, and yet he's so insecure and so unsure of himself, and he's sort of on the back end of his career, and he's really kind of... He's more sad than anything else. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he's sort of classic cowboy, you know, American hero kind of guy. And he's both at the same time. And so I wonder if it's just really interesting that he's choosing roles like this, where he would rather play the Big Lebowski than the Tom Cruise character, which is also kind of a name check in this film.
Right.
You know, look at Tom Cruise and look at the kind of characters that he chooses to play. They're superheroes.
They're clean too.
They're clean. They're morally upright.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'll throw in a little bit of like Tropic Thunder every now and again, but for the most part, he's got it.
That wasn't his movie.
He's got a certain type of character he 100%. Wants to play.
100%.
And DiCaprio is absolutely more interested in playing the beta.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he's perfect in this role. And yet he sells a movie like an alpha, you know? It's like he's going to sell a movie every bit as hard as Tom Cruise. And yet, he is as good looking as anyone else in Hollywood. You know, he's got those piercing blue eyes. And yet, I can't think of the last time he played anyone that was kind of heroic. Does that make sense?
I think so. I want to look at his filmography really quick. He, to me, is he's like this messy. The way that we were talking about Tom Cruise just now, I see him as clean.
Yeah,
I see him as a digital, like, you know, the camera brand Red, which is like that top of the line digital. Clarity of the image is extraordinary. You don't have to light a scene very much because it just picks up. I mean, it's just such a technically proficient machine. And DiCaprio is like an analog film camera to me. He's messy, he's grainy, he's loud.
Last one DiCaprio did where he was sort of classic movie star heroic was Inception. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good point.
I did not think he was great in, to be honest. Like, I don't think that's for me, that I wouldn't put that near the top of a DiCaprio performance.
That is a movie I can just watch, though.
Is that right?
I'll say that. Yeah. It's just kind of it's a Rubik's Cube of a movie.
Okay. Interesting.
So
I could see that. So DiCaprio, let me ask you this question. I think DiCaprio is not the leading actor of this movie. I think he's a supporting actor. Okay. Even though he's sort of the big face.
I think it's Sean Penn's movie, isn't it?
I think it's Willa's movie. Okay. And I think until Willa's introduced, it's Perfidia's movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've got, you know, Sean Penn in sort of the classic villain role. But I think that DiCaprio, even though he's the big face on the poster, even though he's the one that sells the movie, he's really the supporting actor. In the same way, I think that in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that's really Brad Pitt's movie.
Brad Pitt was so... There was something that he brought into that role that he's almost unrecognizable to me in the way that when an actor loses themselves,
yeah,
when you don't see them anymore. That, I think, to me, that's probably one of Brad Pitt's best movies.
I think it is. And I think that it's probably one of DiCaprio's best movies. And yet, I think that we are mistaking. I think he's just choosing really great supporting actor roles.
And I think,
and that's for whatever cool. reason, he fools us into thinking that he's the main actor.
Right. Because he is a legitimate movie star in the
A-list
stat,
right?
If you see his name on a movie,
it sells the movie.
You just go to the movie because it's DiCaprio's in.
That's right. That's right.
You don't, I don't know what this movie's about. I see DiCaprio looking like Lebowski with big, you know, the big glasses my dad used to wear. And I'm like, the fuck is this? And then I go see the movie.
Oh yeah. Those glasses also kind of harken back to like the blast helmets.
Yeah. Oh,
for Star Wars, right?
They totally do.
And he's got the robe, which is a little bit like the Jedi's robe. And just a nice tight bow on this. At the end of the movie, when he has a showdown with Willa, Willa's little gun has a little sort of sci-fi looking targeting.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. It's got a little laser. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Which, to me, it's just like, oh my gosh, this is Star Wars. Anyway, let's get back to DiCaprio. I think he's the supporting actor. And I think
disagree.
That the argument against this is that he's the constant from the beginning of the film to the end.
Right.
And so these other actors kind of come and go out of the narrative where he has probably, maybe he has the most screen time. I don't know.
I think so.
But he's not classically the hero. He doesn't save Willa in the end.
No, she saves herself.
She saves herself. He's sort of there to like give her a ride, you know, right. And he's there to like, you know, be a supportive dad. But at the end of the movie, yeah, he can't even take a selfie. Right.
I think that's why part of the reason that this film is so interesting and it's so hard to not accept it for high level work is because it defies storytelling norms and forms.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
We have a list. We have the outline that we were going to do with Jean. And at the bottom, there's like, 10 or plus more comps and trope things that we pulled out. And as I was looking over that list today, you know, the French Connection, Jackie Brown, Lebowski, Strange Love, Civil War, American Anthem, which is a book, Pipeline, Say Nothing, Kill Bill, you listed Black Klansman, Bonnie and Clyde, Natural Born Killers, there's like all this stuff. None of the comps or tropes that you can pull out of this, I pull out from this movie, ever reside for me in the place of Anderson borrowing something because he doesn't know how to get out of a situation. So I'm going to borrow this trope from another movie, or I'm going to use this plot mechanic from another story, or I'm going to do that thing that they did in Star Wars or whatever, right? And none of it is homage. Oh, I loved French Connection, so I'm going to do my car chase. None of it is, he's leaning on nothing. But all of those, they're like spirits or presences with us. They're all there with us. But they're never in competition. They're never competing with each other.
Yes. I would say it like this. I would say he's so comfortable with his own voice.
Oh, 100%.
He knows exactly what his own film style is. That he can grab these homages and it not feel like, oh, you're cribbing someone else. They're being put in service to a film that is from start to finish his voice.
Yeah.
Yep. Even down to like, you know, his sort of family relationships, you know, his own emotional connection to his own daughters.
Right. Right.
You know, these are things that he's writing himself into these movies. And so these movies are so personal that even if he is going to, you know, kind of wink to Kill Bill, it's not in that moment isn't going to like take you out and make you think, oh, you're trying to be Tarantino at this
point. 100%. And I think that's a level of mastery. And then for DiCaprio to then slide into this in the non-standard role as I'm the face of the movie, but I'm not the hero of the movie. And I'm not even the anti-hero of the movie. The movie isn't really about me. I'm just a part and flow of the movie and of the wheel turning and a revolution and counter revolution and, you know, the generations and generations moving forward. And for him to put himself into that position, I think that's, I used to hate DiCaprio.
Oh, is that right?
I did not like him. Titanic.
Interesting.
What the beach, you know, all that stuff. I was just like,
I was kind of on board with him after Gilbert Grape.
Okay.
So I was sort of interested in him as an actor. And I did like the beach, but I think, I was probably like you thinking Titanic is just going to be syrupy schlock. But happily surprised by Titanic. You know, I'm sure a lot of people felt the same way. But I'm kind of invested in this. But I'll even rewatch. What was the movie where he fights the bear? What was it called?
Oh, that's one of my favorites of his. The Revenant.
The Revenant. A lot of people hated The Revenant. I will rewatch it.
I love that, and I love. Iñárritu, Alejandro González Iñárritu, the director of that. I think it's a gorgeous film, and I think it's not a film for everybody. I'll say that, but because it's that brutalist survival kind of horror.
And it's a revenge film. And were you familiar with either of the lead female actors in this film?
No, not prior to this.
Okay, they were revelations to me. I couldn't take my eyes off either one of them. When they are on screen, they're the most interesting thing about the movie.
Regina Hall, Teyana Taylor, and Chase Infinity. Actually, yeah, three people really.
Right.
Assuming you're including Regina Hall.
I am. Absolutely. In fact, there's a scene where they're like around a campfire. And I don't think I didn't even know her name. I didn't know Regina Hall's name at this point, but she's on a screen with one of the A-list actors of Hollywood.
Right.
And I just can't take my eyes off her. There's something about her eyes that just convey a sense of authenticity and earnestness and concern. I just feel like there's something about her eyes that hold the camera in such a way that make me think I have to know more about that person.
That's star power.
Teyana Taylor was a force of nature. I think you probably talk about, you know, maybe her portrayal on film with Jean, but I do think that they're in terms of an anti-hero, like I'm mesmerized. I'm just mesmerized by her when she's on screen. She absolutely overshadows DiCaprio whenever 100%. She's on screen.
100%.
She's going toe to toe with Sean Penn. And I believe
in highly charged scenes.
And I believe at every moment that those two are equals. And I just like, I don't like, is he going to get the upper hand on her? Is she going to get the, like, in terms of like the characters in the story, but also in terms of acting chops, I'm not thinking, well, of course, Sean Penn's gonna rule the day at the end of this or not. That's saying something. That is absolutely saying something. So anyway, I was thrilled with him. And then of course, you know, you get to Chase Infinity, which I knew her from the Presumed Innocence series on Apple.
Right.
She was very good in that.
Was she one of the, was a daughter? Was she a daughter?
She was the daughter
Right, we started that and we dropped out early on. So
I think she was good. It was sort of a flawed television show,
it's a little weird.
I thought she was really great, but after this movie, I feel like, oh my gosh, you're going to be one of the biggest stars in Hollywood for the next 30 years. Mm-hmm. Let me just say this. She was in the Luke Skywalker role and she was so much more charismatic than Hamill. I mean, just such an improvement over Mark Hamill. Like, I'm so more interested in what she has to do in the future. So she was amazing. And I think that there's something about her performance in this movie that conveys a sense of vulnerability and just the potential for a heroic ending. And I don't think either one gets sacrificed toward the end. I don't feel like she's a superhero at the end.
Right.
I don't feel like she's sort of, you know, punching above her weight and then she, you know, she sort of dominates and now she's Neo from the Matrix. I don't get the sense of that. I feel like she's still believably a 16-year-old girl who has been put in just these horribly traumatic situations. But by force of just luck or her own, you know, sheer will, you know, her name's Willa, she's able to get sort of overcome. She's able to overcome and put herself in a position where now she is the next generation's hero, but not perfect. I really don't feel at the end of this that she loses her humanity.
Right. Right.
You know, she doesn't don tights and a cape at the end of this.
Right.
So I think that that's kind of a magical introduction to a new hero.
And then when you think about the fact that Regina Hall, little less so, but Teyana Taylor and Chase Infinity, like you mentioned, but it widened this frame out a little bit. They're both going toe-to-toe with DiCaprio and Del Torres and Sean Penn. And they are matching those guys who have incredible careers beat for beat, energy level for energy level.
Yeah.
Teyana Taylor's performance is so, like you were saying before, the on-screen energy that she was giving to that performance. Bob Ferguson's a kind of a crazy character. You know, DiCaprio like really leans into his craziness. Sean Penn really leans into Lockjaw's craziness. And she's there for as much as she's on screen.
Yeah.
She's laying out the same amount of performance energy as those two guys and outshining them both simultaneously.
Okay. Let's talk about the in-world motivations. My impression of Perfidia Beverly Hills is that she is not idealistically pure in the same way that you would find in Les Miserables. My impression is that she's a thrill seeker, kind of like in one of the who is the main photographer in Alex Garland's Civil War.
Carry on and I'll look it up.
I think that there are some people who are in it for, I think some people are in the revolution for
Kirsten Dunst.
No. Who's the male?
Kaylee Spaney, Wagner Moura.
Okay. Yeah. Wagner Moura's character in that film, I felt like he's interested in sort of the artistic and the integrity of being a photographic journalist. But there's a part of his personality that is absolutely in it for the thrill. Like he's
100%.
He's a thrill junkie, this guy.
And there was some criticism around Civil War or around that. And I played at photojournalism for a while.
Yeah.
And I knew a bunch of
people who were in it for the thrill.
And I've been in situations where domestic, not in a war zone, but in a police action, heavy police action. I've been gassed a few times.
Yeah, yeah.
And I will 100% tell you that a big chunk of the job of being that kind of a conflict-based, you know, or a photojournalist who looks for conflict is they're in it for the thrill of it.
Right. And 100%. I would imagine, now I don't have experience.
Along with having idealistic journalism values.
Okay.
Both right. can be true.
Right? Well, then maybe in this way, my sense of Perfidia kind of parts ways with the analogy, but my sense is that in revolutions, you really need ideologues to kind of set the mission.
Nemec.
And sell the story, sell the narrative. And then you also need people who are thrill seekers.
Yeah.
Sometimes those people can be very useful. I get the sense with her is that she's more of a thrill seeker. And maybe
she's charismatic and she's passionate and that rallies people to the cause. Yeah,
maybe that's kind of rallies people to the cause, but I don't get the sense that she's much of an ideologue.
Correct.
I kind of changed my tune on this after talking with my wife at the end of the movie, but I got the sense that it wasn't like she made this big shift and kind of became a traitor to save her own skin. I kind of mm-hmm. felt like she was always a little bit self-centered or a lot self-centered.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with Bob. I feel like I never got the sense that he was much of an ideologue. I feel like he had a certain set of expertise. He was a great bomb maker. And I think that he's sort of drawn into her cult of personality. I think he gets a thrill from, you know, the declaration of war. I don't really see a window into him as a committed revolutionary. And by the time we meet him 16 years later, he's so much more into Steely Dan than he is to sort of keep, you know, keeping up the revolutionary persona. So I don't know if, like when I said at the beginning of the movie, I didn't really feel like there were any real heroes. To me, that's kind of what I meant. I kind of felt like both Willa's parents were absolutely revolutionaries, but I never got the sense that they were telling me the story that these guys were ideologically pure in any way, shape, or form.
I think, too, with Bob, an additional dimension is the PTSD that he had and the self-medicating sure, he was doing.
A lot of self-medicating. One of the funniest things in the movie is when he's trying to explain why his brain's flat or fried. Yeah. I have been doing drugs and alcohol for 30 years. I am a drug and narcotic lover.
And I love, and this goes into the other point I was going to make, is that Anderson doesn't shy away from making his character
yes.
human.
That's right.
Be it postpartum depression, be it
yeah.
self-medication and being honest about self-medicating. Like, hey, man, I'm messed up. I'm all high because yeah. like I did bad stuff in the bad days.
But, yeah, that was the conversation I had with Sarah after the movie was over when I was trying to figure out her motives.
Mm.
And I was saying, I never got the sense that she had any connection to her daughter. And what Sarah said was, oh, she was totally in postpartum depression.
Totally. Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, that totally makes sense. Because at the end, I was thinking, nothing that this woman has done so far would convince me that she's able to write the letter that she writes
mm-hmm.
to her daughter. It just seems so out of character with everything I knew about her. And so I even went so far as to think, like, did she even write the letter? Is this maybe Bob's, you know, forgery?
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
And I would wonder, is that kind of silver lining at the end of this film earned? And what Sarah said was, yeah, but she was in postpartum depression. You can't draw anything about her ethical character from the way that she's reacting to the birth of her daughter. And I totally got that. I was like, oh my gosh, I did not see that going in, but I kind right. of needed Sarah to help me see that.
I had a bout of depression maybe a year and a half or two into our after my daughter was born. So it's not postpartum in the same way as your, you know, for 9-ish months, your body has turned into a complete differently chemically souped up machine. But there is a big shift that we have to go through as adults or children, whatever, whenever we have children, and we have to reorient our lives. My father-in-law said this, is that, you know, you become aware of the world in a way that you never understood before, because you're now responsible for the life of somebody else. And that is going to alter your framework radically, assuming you're committed to, you know, to being the best parent you can be. And I mean, I'm not lauding that as a virtuous or whatever, just as, you know, it's about choices and about choices people make in the world of their circumstances. And for Perfidia, who I think you're right, and this goes back to this question of Anderson's not giving us superheroes in capes. He's not giving us clean hero, anti-hero, mustache twirling villain, you know, what have you. He's giving the primary characters a lot of depth and complexity. You know, the Christmas boys, the Christmas Day Club, whatever, I forget what they're called.
The Christmas Adventurers
Club. Yes, that's it. They're mustachio, two-dimensional twirling, right? That's fine.
Cartoon villains, for sure.
But our primary characters are three-dimensional. They're living, they're alive. And so I think Perfidia can be a revolutionary. She can be a thrill seeker. She can be a mother who went through a terrible bout of postpartum depression to the point where that she could no longer stay in that circumstance and had to make a choice for her well-being, albeit within the realm of a really messed up relationship with Lockjaw and the American justice system, which then entangles us into the whole world of racial politics and America's fascination with fascism and all of this stuff. But she can absolutely be a complex, multifaceted character. And as much as she's not on screen, her presence across the screen, the whole story, is always there. She's always present with us, even though she may not be in frame.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Her shadow is over the whole movie. Let me ask you a question about her. Do you feel at the end of this movie that she's still alive?
Yes.
I keep on going back and forth on this for two reasons. One, she's, according to the Christmas Adventurers Club, she's MIA, right? Mm-hmm. So they're unable to find her. And then Sean Penn's character says at one point, "I put your mother in the ground."
Oh, I missed that. Okay. So it's not fresh. The movie's not fresh in my mind.
I don't know if I can trust either one. I think that we're dealing with unreliable narrators here, but then the sense that we don't get her, you know, knocking on the door at the end. It's just a letter.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's supposed to be an open question. Like, is this person still alive or not?
And I'm fine. I am on record with being fine with ambiguity of these kinds of things. I don't always need the answer.
Yeah, I guess I was just kind of curious, like toward the end, what your impression is of the.
It's not fresh in my mind, and so there's obviously clues that I could have missed, but my feeling is, yes, she's alive, and. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe that's my half full, you know, optimist view is that there is still a possibility that her and Willa could have
reunite,
you know, and reestablish a personal relationship. I mean, not an easy thing to do, but if people are willing, you know, you can work it out.
Yeah, and I get the sense that she would be, I get the sense Will is totally open to this. Now, in opposition, like if we were going to argue the other side, at one point when DiCaprio is in Del Toro's car, he says he can't believe that Lockjaw found him and knocked on his door. He's like, I always thought it would be her mother who did that.
Mm.
Suggesting that maybe DiCaprio doesn't know whether she's alive or dead. But at least
that would make sense.
At least she's, I mean, if you think that she wrote the letter and it's not a forgery, she was at least alive a couple years ago.
Right.
So I don't know if there's a good answer to that, to that particular, for me, it's an open question.
And I think if we go back to what you had mentioned earlier about the positive silver lining of this story, that there is a possibility that she's alive adds to that tenor, right? Adds to that feeling of things are not over, and there is a possibility that Willa and her mom could connect.
I think Del Toro will win Best Supporting. he's so fantastic in this movie. I was listening to an interview with PTA, and he basically mm-hmm. said that, you know, he's been working on this script for over 10 years.
Right.
But all of
20, I think, actually.
All of the sensei parts were like written in one night. He's like, it basically a day and a half. He's like, we wanted Benicio. We brought him in. He had this whole backstory, and he's like, the absolute, he had that character just down pat. They sat down in a day and a half and wrote that entire scene.
Amazing.
And he said, and I think it's the best part of the movie. And I kind of agree, like that the amount of comedy and action that happened with Sensei is so perfect. And it really kind of, it almost is sort of the heart of the movie. And I think because people will not recognize that DiCaprio is actually a supporting actor, I think it's possible that Benicio Del Toro actually gets Best Supporting Actor this year.
Interesting. Yeah, that could be. That could be. His performance, his portrayal really pulled for me the Fred Finster character from Usual Suspects.
Uh-huh.
Just sort of that, you know, rolling with it, highly competent, but on surface, you're just like, what is up with this dude?
He's got this whole system in place. Like it's interesting. Like I can't claim that I'm super tapped into this world, but most of my students are pastors, and I would say probably six or seven of them are pastors of minority congregations in New York City.
Uh-huh.
And what they tell me is that they've got parishioners who are scared to leave their house. They're scared to come to church. They're scared to go to the grocery store. They're scared mm-hmm. to ride the bus because they fear, you know, ICE capturing them in transit from one place to the next.
Right.
And they just live in this constant fear. And so these pastors are forced to be put in the position of a refugee leader. And their churches become refuges in the same way that sort of the Sacred Heart Church is used as a refuge
mm-hmm.
for Del Toro's community. And so that's to me, that's all very realistic to our sense, sort of our political climate right now. And yet he's by far the funniest guy in this whole movie. Like he's hilarious, and he's so crucial to the darkest heart of this movie as well. Mm-hmm.
There was a line that he drops that really hit me about that, and I'm paraphrasing and I'm adding on to it. that brown non-white communities have been operating in these ways for a long time. So
yeah, what he says is we've been laid siege for 300 years.
Right.
He's like, you did nothing wrong. You didn't bring this to my door. We've been dealing with this for 300 years. So
it's so profound.
It is. It's so great.
And again, this is what terrified me about the movie is seeing these paramilitarized forces operating with this level of not only impunity, but efficiency and effectiveness.
And why are they there at all? Because of Sean Penn's personal,
right?
You know, his personal gripe, his personal interest.
He's got to clean up his thing. He's got his reputation so that he can join the Christmas.
I mean, of course, it's all in service to white supremacy, but it's absolutely a personal vendetta that he's trying to settle as mm-hmm. well, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you've got this, you know, the best fighting force the world's ever known put in service to just the most depraved,
right,
ill-begotten motive that you could imagine.
And these soldier, you know, these paramilitarized soldiers, you know, they're doing police action because they're not just dropping a bomb on the whole city block, right? That's a difference between military and paramilitary and sort of police on a spectrum. But these guys, and I'm using the word guys specifically, are trained and honed for this. So they don't care. They're just in it because that's what they do. And whether it's Lockjaw's, you know, desire to gain acceptance into this club, which is really interesting for his character too, because he has power, but yet he's subservient to power. And that puts him in an interesting position as a villain.
Well, he has a want, you know?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
He absolutely has a want that motivates him. At first, it's like he's just has animal attraction,
right,
to this woman who he cannot take his eyes off.
Right.
He's infatuated.
And the hypocrisy is palpable, right?
Yes.
It's the thing that he hates and wants to suppress, but he cannot divest himself of.
And then he's drawn to power. You know, he wants to be part of this club that views themselves as superior men and worship Saint Nick.
You know, something I realized too, he got what he wanted because he died sitting in his office believing that he had achieved that he had obtained his want.
Well, and I think that this is where we start talking about sort of the generational differences, right? Mm-hmm. Like isn't this sort of a commentary on sort of the older Gen Xers who, like, you know, this is sort of their teleological end. Oh. You're going to wind up in a corner office in a really kind of depressing building think that you've arrived and you're going to put your foot up and really, what have you accomplished in the end?
Right.
You know, you're going to die like a dog at the end. So I think that there's something about a commentary on sort of the failures of, I mean, if you look at the book, the failures of the baby boomers, right? In the world of this film, it's the failures of the Gen Xers, and there's a commentary on what one generation has left undone, and really what that generation requires the next generation to clean up in the aftermath.
I've been thinking about that. I won't say that I've been thinking about that a lot, but that those thoughts are on the periphery of my mind throughout the goings-ons of my days as I'm thinking about my 10-year-old daughter and what it is that she's going to have to manage for
Oh man.
Ecologically, politically, you know, all these things. And I think from a social and political standpoint, I don't know that the dynamics are all that fundamentally different in the sense of who has power and control mm-hmm. and the struggle for creating spaces where it's power. It's not all about power over, but power with. But I think the one, and this movie is not talking about this at all, but the one element that is fundamentally changed is climate and ecology. And that is not something that humanity has faced in this.
Well, and this,
whereas we've had despotic rulers before, we've had civil wars before, we've had global wars before. Those are all things that we have a point of view of based on the past.
It's interesting that you say that because I think that there's also a commentary on the next generation's relationship to their phones.
Yes, for sure.
And that would be a key shift for sure. I think it's interesting.
Information, the speed at which information moves.
The reveal that she doesn't have a phone and that she does have a phone is so brilliant.
Yeah.
So it's so great.
Very insightful.
Perfect. Perfect. And then the way that this ends with, you know, DiCaprio trying to figure out what a smartphone does. This is really, I've got kind of a rapid fire, sort of film homages.
Okay. Let's do it.
I'm just going to go through them like really quickly.
Do it.
Jim Downey, was one of the Christmas Adventurers.
Yes, 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 I recognize.
And he's sort of a famous SNL writer who sort of PTA picked out of obscurity because he never really acted before except for like in a Happy Gilmore or whatever.
Was it Jim Downey? There was another guy as one of the Christmas Adventurers too that I
mean, there was a few for sure, but Jim Downey was sort of the older, thinner guy with the round face.
Okay.
Fantastic. He was in There Will Be Blood. He is also in the new HBO show with Tim Robinson called The Chair Company.
Okay.
And I just always love to see him pop up. I thought that the beginning of this movie was very reminiscent of Punch Drunk's Love's beginning with in terms of the music choice.
Okay.
I thought in one of the scenes, there's a reference to Jungle Pussy.
Yeah.
And that she died. And then the hitman basically said, oh, well, the pussy died, which is an absolute draw from Kill Bill.
Okay.
Referencing
okay.
The bride's pussy wagon.
Okay.
So that was a clear homage, I thought.
Got it.
I liked the fact that Charlene was put in a basket and spirited away into the night. I thought that was a little Moses typology there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, for
that
sure.
That was really nice. I loved the, I loved the scene with Bluto when Bluto is sort of the younger Hispanic kid that gets interrogated. And the interrogator says, do I look like your father? And he says a little bit. it was just perfectly delivered. These are actors I've not seen in anything else. They're just, man, just left an indelible mark in that scene. I'm always going to think about that for sure. And most importantly for me, that I'm never going to forget in this movie is this running bureaucratic red tape conversation he has to have with Comrade Joshua on the phone, which is so Punch Drunk Love, you know, that he has to have those conversations. It's Adam Sandler has to have those conversations in Punch Drunk Love with Philip Seymour Hoffman. And he has all of these conversations over the phone where he's just trying to be understood or get through or find out some information. And you have this confrontation over the phone that for me is just, there's just something about Comrade Joshua that is so deeply funny. You know, even these revolutionaries have these
officious rule following. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Just unbelievable. And just sort of being laid in it at the end. You know, you clearly don't have children. All the conversations between DiCaprio and Comrade Joshua is just perfect.
And it goes in, that part leans into the absurdist nature of the naming of the nuns and their convent, which I don't remember off the top of my head as well.
The Sisterhood of the Proud Beaver.
Yes. And they're growing weed in the California desert.
Is that a joke against God? I love all that. It's interesting.
And the
to
names
me.
And there's just he layers in all this absurdism,
yeah,
which helps us process the humor. Helps us process these really heavy things if they're not leavened in a way. And because this is this hyperspeed storyline and this stumbling forward chase, one crazy scene after another leads into another. The absurdism, I think, helps leaven all of
it. Yeah, and one of the things that is sort of a thread of that absurdity is all the code speak that runs from the beginning of this movie to the end.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous, and it's sort of called up for its absurdity in that conversation. And yet at the end, it really is important for that final confrontation when traumatized Willa, who's just killed a hitman, is pointing a gun at her father and demanding the code speak.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just trying to finally connect, no more code speak. It's me. And not really realizing it's, interesting. A little bit of Blood Diamond in that scene. I just realized.
Interesting.
being as sort of as traumatized and as sort of in the midst of bat, in the throw of battle. And so in warrior mode that you don't recognize your own father.
Right.
Speak is absolutely necessary to make that scene work.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. So he's laid the groundwork. Yes.
And when DiCaprio comes around the corner and realizes it's his daughter pointing the gun at him, I have no idea what's going to happen.
Right. Is she going to shoot on impulse?
Is she going to shoot him?
Yeah.
Is this going to be this a tragic Greek misunderstanding?
Mm-hmm.
The movie has not given me any indication about how this is going to end. And, I think it ends perfectly. I think it's perfect. But in that scene, I'm completely enthralled. I do not know what the script is.
He's ramped up the tension.
Yes.
So tightly that anything could. Yeah. The catch on the spring could release and it could all be. Terribly messy. And again, I think that goes into the realism of this in that she is freaked the fuck out
and
is high on so much adrenaline right now. And that's real, right?
She's
that is
been
a
kidnapped.
Real.
She just met her biological father who turns out he's a supervillain.
Right.
And she's almost been killed. Four or five times
hauled off to a bunch of 1776ers or whatever they called them. The Jason, Jason, whatever.
I think that they were called 1776ers.
Right.
I mean, and just narrowly escaped all of these situations and sort of.
And a human being who's hopped up on that much adrenaline and fear, anything could happen
anything
in that
could
moment.
Happen. That's right. That's right.
And I think that was one of the emotional punches of the movie is that setting all this artifice aside, setting all the code speak and whatever, and Bob is just trying to be, look, I'm just a father, just trying to look after my daughter. And there's all this spider web stuff that I'm trying to get my way through and then just be, it's me. It's just me and you're just you. And you're safe. It hits, right?
It's what you want. You desperately want those two to
connect,
be reunited.
Yeah.
And for everything to be healed in the end. And
then we cycle again when she goes off to the next.
Yeah. And it ends perfectly. He's on the couch fiddling with his phone. She zooms away to Tom Petty's American Girl, telling us not so subtly, this is what America ought to really look like. Mm-hmm. It's this girl with this complexion, with these dreams in her heart.
And she's got tactical training and she has survival instincts and
it's been hope through the ringer. The next generation, which I was definitely not expecting.
Right.
Definitely not expecting that at all. So I think just the ending alone makes it different than a lot of these other PTA movies.
I would agree. Having not seen Licorice Pizza or Magnolia or, you know, some of, but he does it. He's got these, I don't know, the spread, he's either chasing these like megalomania characters or he's doing these lighthearted sexual comic romps or something. I don't know.
And yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's a fascinating choice for a film given his filmography.
Yeah. And then to push all of the production and design choices forward, practical sets, practical explosions, VistaVision, you know, the film, just doing the whole thing on film, all of this stuff. He's pushed the art form. He's re-expanded boundaries of the art form that have been dormant for a long while, I think, in a lot of ways. And I think that's what part of why it feels so fresh and why the Oscar talk is so palpable, because there is a richness to this film that we don't see in a lot of other sausage factory films, right? Which is really what dominates our high-level box office media.
Hey, one more scene that just I can't get out of my head. It's when Willa's going to meet Sean Penn for the first time. Lockjaw. What a wonderful name, Lockjaw. She gets brought in to this cathedral setting. The camera's in the rafters.
Oh, man. Right.
All of the pews have been removed, and he's in the front enthroned. It's like she's walking into a throne room.
Mm-hmm.
This is like Palpatine or whatever. And she walks in and you just see her enter as sort of, I don't know, it's almost Arthurian. You know, it's almost like she's, you know, she's sort of young Arthur walking in and enthroned as the evil king who's just waiting for her to enter. That shot is just unbelievable. And then what has happened? So she comes in. He tells her to come closer. He gets out of the throne and puts her in the throne. It's almost as if symbolically, he's foreshadowing the transfer of
generational power.
Yeah, of generational power. And then he kind of moves over to the side and just has kind of this odd exchange with a daughter, with his biological daughter. And you can kind of see he's as stupid and feckless, and he's as much of a sad sack as DiCaprio is.
Yep.
This is him trying to display his sort of, you know, alpha male personality and completely failing, because we know, and the audience knows, that the person with power is the person sitting in that chair. And so she becomes so much more powerful than he is, because just because of who he is.
He's strike me down and I shall become more powerful than ever.
Exactly. As soon as he says that, you know what's going to happen, right? The hero's going to win in the end.
Right.
But this is in a movie that it's hard to script in that way. It's hard to know. But I think on a rewatch, that scene is so impressive.
I can't wait for this to get out on video on demand so I can, you know, break it down even more.
I'm sure there's 100 themes just like, you know, 100 scenes just like that.
Right.
But there's just a few of them that are just really stick with.
Well, I think this is a good place to maybe wrap it up and we can pick up further conversation in the near future. Because I don't think we're done talking about this film.
Yeah.
There are just so many facets to it that we've barely even talked about racial politics or America's fascination with fascism. And but yet it's a fascination with Black culture, women in revolutions and liberation movements. And I mean, there's just all kinds of stuff.
Anti-heroes, villains, heroes, you know, the slow deterioration of people who love Steely Dan.
Speaking of which,
all right, yeah, no, this is going to be a movie I watch a lot.
Yeah,
you know, this will be one that 10 years from now I'll probably want to revisit.
Sounds good. All right, man.
Thanks.
Talk soon.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and comments to lorehounds@thelorehounds.com. Get ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts on Patreon or Supercast, and connect with us on Blue Sky and join us on our Discord server. Links for everything are in the link tree in the show notes of this episode. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.